Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is Two Doctors Answering the Internet. Next question, back to the medicine side here. Why is there such a large rise in colon cancer? All right, so let me give people a lay of the land, and then I'll pose the question directly to you. So in the United States, there's approximately 150,000 new cases of large bowel cancer every year. So that's just your large colon. Annually, about 50,000 people die from colorectal cancer in the United States, and their lifetime incidence of colorectal cancer is about 4%. Okay, in the United States, colorectal cancer incidence rates have been declining by approximately 2% per year, but this rate of decline has slowed to approximately 1.2% per year in the period from 2014 to 2018. So it's been going down, but then as of late, it's been going down less. And notably, in the United States, the declining mortality overall is masking trends in younger adults. So colorectal mortality rates per 100,000 people in the population amongst individuals aged less than 50 have declined by about 2% per year from 2000 to 2004. But then after that has been increasing by about 1% through 2018. So things had been going down for like years and years and years. And now as of late, they've been going up, especially in people under the age of 50. So overall, the incidence of colorectal cancer is increasing in individuals under the age of 50, while it is decreasing in older individuals in the United States and Western countries. So with that lay of the land out of the way, Dr. Baraki, why is there such a large rise in colon cancer in younger people?
Yeah, certainly a concerning finding and pretty relevant as at the moment. I happen to be taking care of somebody with this very issue at the moment, which is pretty tough to watch that happen to somebody so young. And it's something that's been investigated quite a bit. I don't think that we have a single, you know, definitive cause nailed for this kind of thing. Most, as with most cancers, there are a couple cancers that are like pretty simple. And it's like, you got this one gene mutation and that's it. And if we treat that one gene mutation, then this becomes a treatable cancer, like CML, for example. But most cancers are much more complex, multifactorial, not necessarily homogeneous, meaning they're not all the same. Even if you have the same cancer diagnosis, you have unique tumor biology between people and things that may have predisposed you or led to it, or certain different levels of aggressiveness and how it manifests in you. So all in all, super complex field. There's a reason why there are people who dedicate their lives to studying this and people who specialize and dedicate their lives to treating it. And I'm not one of those people, even though I see folks with cancer daily or the complications of cancer, et cetera. As it relates to colorectal cancer, it's something that does have a lot of different risk factors, a lot of predisposing things, some genetic, less commonly, and then some things that are more behaviorally related. And so obesity is a major variable here. It's one of the obesity-associated cancers. There's a list of those, obesity and its associated, oftentimes, you know, insufficiently active lifestyle habits. The quote-unquote Western diet, which involves a lot of consumption of highly processed meats and low, generally low fiber intake from whole foods, are things that are pretty consistently and strongly linked to the risk of colorectal cancer. And then other things like alcohol and smoking have some relationship. It might not be quite as strong as some of these other variables. There are tons of other kind of hypotheses that are being investigated. For example, are there issues with the gut microbiome that increases this risk, or is that just a, you know, another derangement that happens because of the diet and the activity, or is one causing the other? It's hard to say. Various aspects around inflammation. We know, for example, patients with inflammatory bowel disease are at much, much, much higher risk of developing colon cancer. So they get screened way more aggressively starting much earlier in life. And so, yeah, there's a ton of other kind of hypothetical or things that are being researched. But I think that the best guess at the moment is kind of this westernized diet, obesity, and the associated behaviors as far as the biggest, at least easily modifiable factors on the individual level to mitigate your risk of colorectal cancer. So shifting the dietary pattern in a much healthier direction, increasing fiber from whole food sources, maintaining, you know, healthy body composition, physical activity, not smoking, not drinking, all the usual things that any good doctor would tell you, things that we advise frequently, would be most of the things that I would advise to mitigate your risk as much as possible. And then if you wanted to take it further than that, then initiating, you know, age-appropriate screening when that time comes by working with a physician on that.
Yeah. A lot of the conditions that we see, like an increased quote-unquote prevalence of, particularly during this era of modernity, I just initially go to obesity, insufficient physical activity, and the current dietary pattern, because from a time perspective, temporally, it just makes sense. Most of these conditions have like a long or relatively long latent period. You know, they start early and then insidiously kind of turn into a problem later in life. And yeah, we're talking about people under the age of 50, but you know, 30s and 40s, that's not exactly like a short term sort of thing. This has been going on, festering for a long period of time. These risk factors where people are carrying too much adipose tissue, where people are eating a dietary pattern that's not really that health promoting, and they're insufficiently active. And so to me, those are the most likely smoking guns, so to speak. And then we can identify other things that are downstream from that. But I don't feel confident enough to say like, it's just obesity. So yeah. And hand wave it away, because that would be a smooth brain take, as we've. Yeah. So, do you want to talk about screening real quick? Because these have recently changed, and I just want people who are listening to this, there are probably some folks in this demographic, you know?
Yeah. So, the guidelines did recently change within the past, it might have been the last year or 2 years ago, whereas historically, average risk individuals, so those who don't necessarily, for example, have inflammatory bowel disease, or you have a first degree relative who was diagnosed with colon cancer at an early age, if you don't have those kind of risk factors that would put you at elevated risk, that would make you average risk. And historically, average risk individuals were advised for screening at age 50. Because of these trends that have been observed, that guidance has shifted a bit to initiate at age 45. There is admittedly some controversy around this, both within the U.S. and worldwide, and we don't necessarily need to get into all the weeds on that here. There are different modalities that can be used for colorectal cancer screening, stool-based tests that are aimed to be initially non-invasive, and then if they're positive, then you would proceed to a more invasive test like a colonoscopy or a flexible sigmoidoscopy, et cetera. And so those are things to discuss one-on-one with your physician to see if, you know, which one, if any, is more or less appropriate for you. And then the other consideration that is maybe less applicable to our listeners, but something that I teach about a lot, has to do with not only when to start screening, but when to stop screening, when it does not make sense to screen somebody for these things anymore at the older age of the spectrum.
It's like 80-something, isn't it?
Well, it varies based on the patient, right? So if you see an absolute kick-ass 80-year-old who looks like they're going to live for another 40 years, then you know you might have a conversation with them and they might want to continue screening. And others who maybe by that age, they're on death's door, unfortunately, due to other reasons, and it might be a situation where it's no longer appropriate. And so for my trainees that I work with, I often point them to help them understand these concepts to actually an online tool from UCSF. It's called the e-prognosis tool. So I just have them Google UCSF e-prognosis, and on that website, you can actually click the option of, for example, cancer screening relating to breast cancer screening or colon cancer screening, and you can put in your patient's demographics, and it actually helps you weigh out what are the potential benefits of screening and what are the potential harms, and is it actually worth pursuing this in the particular patient that I'm seeing.
Yeah, I like that. We'll have to come with our own gains tool for resistance training. Would resistance training benefit this patient 99.9% of the time?
Yeah, permanently set it to yes with very, very rare exceptions.
Yeah, somebody said, do you have an emergent condition that needs to be, you know?
Do you have complete obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? Okay, yeah, maybe pause until we fix that.
Yeah, or imperforated anus, one of the two. Okay, next question. My latest labs indicate that my low-density lipoprotein, LDL, is up for the first time ever. I'm a 45-year-old healthy female with, quote, mostly good nutrition and exercise. Top tips to reduce. And, you know, we could just sort of say, well, these are the things that can reduce your LDL levels, and we just move on. But I think conceptually, I want our audience, and most of them are probably already aware of this, but when you talk about risk stratification for, like, risk of, in this case, heart disease, it's not just your LDL level in isolation. It is an integration of other risk factors that we know contribute. And in fact, we did a podcast on this this latest tool called the Prevent tool. That was episode 278. I've linked that in the description below. But the risk factors that it incorporates are not just the results from the standard lipid panel, where you would get like an LDL level, an HDL level, and triglycerides and so on, but also what's your current blood pressure, tobacco use status, what's your BMI, social determinants of health are also incorporated if you have a person's zip code, because we know that can play a role. And so when I start thinking about, like, should this even be intervened upon in the first place? The doctor-y answer is like, well, what's your risk? And then we got to plug it into a tool and come up, well, what's your risk at 5 years, 10 years, and so on? And how likely are you to benefit if we take an intervention now? Because this is the sort of dose, you know, related exposure risk. The higher it's elevated and the longer it's elevated for, the higher the risk. But I don't know your LDL level. And, it, you know, for example, if it's like 105, I'm like, okay, like that's close enough to sort of a really good level.
Yeah.
And we know that there's some variation in not only the lab, but also day-to-day variation. So maybe it's fine. I'd want to know more information before I said, you need to lower this right now.
Agreed.
In saying that, however, I am of the opinion, I think you are too, that generally speaking, lower LDL is better. Not, of course, if you have a disease that, like, you know, causes you to have low LDL, but generally speaking, you would prefer lower rather than higher. So if someone had 105 versus 80 and you were like, well, all else being equal, I kind of want the 80, you know, if I had to pick. And so when we start thinking about what sort of things would you do to lower not just LDL, but also the all of the atherogenic sort of lipoproteins. Well, weight loss, if somebody is carrying excess adipose tissue. And I know when I say that, people are like, well, I'm not, you know, I'm healthy. She just said she was healthy. Why are you talking about weight loss? And it's like, well, there's this sort of, individual sort of fat level that above which confers increased risk of disease. And so a person might have a BMI of like 26 or, you know, 24, you know, not even in the overweight category. And you're like, yeah, but I think that there might be some, contributory sort of effects of carrying a little more adipose tissue. So perhaps some weight loss might be beneficial, physical activity. And so somebody who's, you know, says they have good nutrition and exercise, I'm like, yeah, well, how much exercise are you doing? Specifically conditioning in this particular standpoint, because I don't know that there's a big sort of impact from more resistance training than the current guidelines, but I don't feel the same way about a conditioning exercise. If it's 150 minutes per week is the minimum for conditioning, I actually would want somebody achieving maybe double that, just kind of check that box from like this lipid related risk and how to intervene with that with exercise. Fiber intake, another big one, at least 35 grams per day, which most people, even if they have a quote good dietary pattern, may not be getting. And I would again prefer that this comes mostly from whole foods, although in this particular case, I would also be open to increasing supplemental fiber. Smoking, I assume this person is not smoking because I don't know that anybody's under the assumption that like smoking is beneficial. Although there was a firefighter related forum that I was poking around on. This is years ago now. And they were like, do you think we should like smoke cigarettes sometimes just to like get used to inhaling smoke? And I was like, I don't know. Like, do you think radiologists are like, hey, should we like expose ourselves to a little radiation and see if we can get better? Genetics, obviously you can't do anything about, but you would want to know if you had a genetic sort of predisposition to high LDL and other atherogenic lipoproteins. So if this person's LDL was like 300, for example, and it was a fasting test, and you're like, does this person have familial hypercholesterolemia? And like, in which case that would take you down a different maybe, management pathway. And then after that, if someone's like, look, it's high, okay? It's high, and my risk is higher than I want it to be. What to do now? Well, medications, which we've talked about at length, and I'll let you kind of go off on that more, and probably some additional screening to sort of further characterize like, okay, if we do agree that you're at elevated risk, well, how high is that risk? And are there other, you know, how hard should we pull these other levers, right? If you can get a better sense. So do you want to talk about meds and some additional screening stuff here?
Totally. Yeah. So I would want to add a couple things on the dietary front. So I think that from a lifestyle standpoint, if somebody does not have strong genetic predisposition to high blood cholesterol levels, I think that diet is probably the biggest lever that you can pull from a modifiable lifestyle standpoint. I think it tends to be more potent than, than weight loss. I think it tends to be more potent than exercise, actually, specifically for modifying your blood lipids. And so fully agree. I think one of the strongest recommendations we would have would be to really try to crank up the intake of dietary fiber from food sources. And so I often try to get my patients who are interested in making some of these dietary changes to eat foods like berries are a fruit source that is like actually quite dense in fiber. So I personally really like frozen berries in various formats. So that's one option, or any other fruit or vegetable that, you know, non-starchy vegetable that you prefer is likely to come with at least some fiber in it. Legumes like lentils, chickpeas, beans, if you tolerate them from your dietary or digestive standpoint. And then the other tends to be foods like oats and things like that as a couple kind of high potency fiber sources in the diet that I aim for. Aside from fiber, the other thing tends to be more relating to your dietary fat sources, which can also overlap with some of your dietary protein sources. And so what we know is that when people consume high amounts of saturated fats from animal, mostly from animal-derived sources, that tends to have a negative impact on LDL receptor function. So meaning that your body's not as good at clearing LDL out of your blood. And so by substituting out some of those food sources, we can actually improve LDL receptor function. It can clear this stuff out of your blood a little bit more efficiently. So if you consume high amounts of fatty red meats, like ribeyes, for example, if you cook frequently with butter, you eat a lot of butter, that's another source. Certain like coconut fats and things like that also can have this kind of LDL boosting effect. And so substituting those out for unsaturated sources, ideally from like fish, nuts, plant sources, things like that, tend to be health promoting. So I try to get patients, for example, if they eat a fair amount of beef or other saturated, you know, animal fats, substituted out with some kind of fatty fish, incorporating some like mixed nuts into their diet on a regular basis, things like that, altering what cooking oils they're using for food preparation purposes, and then certainly not adding tons of additional fat to their food if they don't, you know, have a need to. So those are some of the dietary changes. As far as meds go, there are a lot of options. We've talked about them a bit before, and getting into the weeds on the meds is a bit outside of probably the time that we're going to allot to this here today, but you know, the first line tends to be statins, and there are many different statin options. There are different statin potencies. There are different statin dosages. And so when I have a patient who does well on one, great. If they don't do well on one, they don't love it, they have some side effects, I'll often trial another. You can try it at very low dose. You can try taking it every other day. You can try taking it every other day at bedtime. These are all strategies to minimize, you know, any kind of adverse effects. And then if you don't tolerate those, then there are alternatives. Or if I really need some potent LDL lowering, I will often combine a low or moderate dose of a statin with a dose of ezetimibe. That combination therapy, low to moderate doses of both have been shown to be as effective as higher doses of statins alone in a few different trials at this point. And so that's something that I tend to use, especially in somebody who I need more aggressive lipid lowering. And I'll tend to use higher doses of multiple different agents to get them as low as possible if they're at very, very high risk. And then lastly, making sure that my overall risk stratification, to your point, is complete, right? So if somebody is completely healthy in every other detectable way, but they have a mildly elevated LDL, I might not be likely to treat that terribly aggressively. If they have higher risk factors, things like that, then I might treat them more aggressively. And part of that risk assessment can involve other testing to include measurements like a lipoprotein little a level or an LP little a, which is something that we had, I believe, a whole dedicated podcast episode to maybe about a year ago or so. Something that's probably under-tested as far as risk stratification goes. There's not currently a U.S. recommendation for widespread screening, but it is recommended in European cardiology guidelines, and it's something that I tend to do with folks, just a one-time check of this. Now, we are pending some upcoming data on medicines and treatments to lower LP little a or lipoprotein little a levels. To see, we know that we can very potently lower those levels. How much does that translate into reducing people's risk of heart disease, which is the next big question to answer before we start actually treating that directly.
Lipodisiran?
I have no idea. Yeah, we'll have to hear some other people pronounce it to see.
Dude.
But this is one among a couple. There's a couple others that also work in different ways. And so we have different options that have already proven that they can lower it, but we got to see, does that actually make people have either fewer heart attacks? Or another risk of having elevated lipoprotein A levels is the premature development of aortic stenosis. And so I've had some patients who developed aortic stenosis by age 50 or something, which is definitely early, and they by and large tend to have either a significant bicuspid aortic valve or lipoprotein little A that's elevated. And so that's something that it would be nice if we could detect that and prevent that, because that's a pretty tough thing to have to go through if you need a valve replaced at midlife.
Yeah. Yep. Links to the stuff in the show notes below. All right. Next question. For microcycle lengths, what do you think is too short and what do you think would be too long? So some definitions here, and then we can riff on this. So a microcycle is the smallest unit of a training cycle that is repeated. So it could be a day, for example, if all of your workouts are exactly the same, maybe you're like a hyper specialized power lifter running like, imagine you're running like a Shaco program, a squat bench deadlift every single time, right? And now, to be fair, in those programs, you do alter intensities and stuff like that, but it's the same exercise, so that really wouldn't count. But imagine if it's just every single day, it's squat, bench, deadlift, 80% of your one rep max for the same number of sets and reps. Technically, your microcycle then would be a day long, and you just repeat it multiple times per week. It more commonly, there are some beginner type programs where it's just two different workouts that are alternated. So in that case, the microcycle length is 2 days. And then most training, like most of our programs, for example, are like a week long microcycle where it's you have a set amount of programming through the week, and that's repeated, you know, each week of the mesocycle, which is basically how long microcycles are repeated for until it's changed. This is also like a block, for example. So usually multiple weeks. And the last thing I'll talk about is the macrocycle, which is the long-term plan of mesocycles, which include all of those repeated units of training, which we call microcycles. The macrocycle typically is over a year, although for like Olympic athletes, it could be like a quadrennial, for example. If the question really is about microcycle length, so like how, you know, what is too short and what is too long, I think that having like a one-day microcycle where you just do the same workout every single time, I think for most people, that's going to be too short. My exception is that if somebody's training like once a week, for example, and that's the only resistance training that they're doing, I could see a case for like a 1 day, you know, sort of microcycle. It's not great, but it's certainly better than not, you know. So I imagine if my dad at some point is like, look, man, I can lift 1 day a week. What do you want me to do? And I give him the same three exercises. That's not probably how I would program it, but I could see if he was like, I just prefer these three or four or whatever it is. I'm doing these in perpetuity. I'm like, all right, I guess your microcycle's a day. I have stronger opinions, though, of how, you know, what is it, too long of a microcycle. I've definitely programmed stuff where a microcycle is really like 2 weeks long, you know, where people are like alternating things, you know, every other week. And so the actual microcycle, instead of being 1 week, it's 2 weeks. But I start thinking about sport, like CrossFit type programming. And if you went from like, all right, workout number one is push jerks, 5 heavy singles, right? And then workout 309, that's when you finally get back to push jerks for 5 singles, you know, and you're repeating the thing all over again. To me, that's too long of a microcycle. It's too much randomization, and you're basically, you've spread out your ability to adapt too far. That's kind of how I'd feel about that. I don't think, though, that this is what the person's asking. I think they're actually asking about, like, how long should a block of training last? What is too short and what is too long? And that I actually have a better answer for, I think. Most of the time, an actual training block, so not a deload block, not a pivot, not a low stress, not like an injury rehab type approach. I think for most people, a mesocycle is going to last somewhere between 3 to 8 weeks on average. If it's a bad program, like or somebody blows up initially and it's just not working, they hate it, whatever, it could be shorter, but you're doing that in response to some feedback that you're getting. Similarly, the mesocycle, the block, could be longer if somebody's off to the races and they're just killing it. For, you know, maybe 10 weeks, maybe 12 weeks. I haven't had people go for much further than that unless we've done some significant modification within the training program, in which case it's not the same mesocycle. So like, yeah, you got to cut it. So most of your training blocks, I think, should be somewhere between like 3 to 8 weeks long. And you should plan on at least having an option to change sometime as you get closer to the end there. The reasons for you needing to change usually come down to 3 major categories. One is logistics. So like your time availability to train has dramatically changed, for example, or your goals dramatically change. You're going to a meet, for example, or you have to, you know, it's in season now. Your preferences. That's another reason to change your training mesocycle, right? Somebody could be getting great results from a particular training program. It's for like hypertrophy, say, and they want to, you know, prep for a powerlifting meet. Well, you have to change your mesocycle. So it's another reason to change. And then the last one is stagnation. As people's results sort of peter out, they become accommodated and accustomed to the training block and they stop making sort of gains. That's another indicator to change things up. Injury would be a fourth category perhaps. So that's what I think about when I think about mesocycle length. Like, what is the optimal mesocycle length? I'm thinking somewhere 3 to 8 weeks, changing it if you need to, if you want to, or if the program is no longer working for you. That's pretty much those are the reasons. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, there's little that I would take issue with in your answer. I think that I would even broaden a little bit up front to where if somebody had a set session that they really enjoyed and they habitually trained twice a week and they didn't have super high performance aspirations and they just wanted to do the same session twice a week, I'd be like, well, again, compared with doing less or doing nothing, like, I'm down with that. I think that if we start doing the same session even more frequently than that, I start to have a little bit more concerns about like overuse syndromes and things like that, right? But if somebody wants to SBD twice a week within reason, I'm like, cool, that's I'm even fine with that. So I also do like it for my own training, for some of the folks that I've been working with, spreading them out across a 2-week repeating cycle to introduce a little bit more variation, not only to, again, mitigate some of that overuse risk, but also just to break people out of the mindset of like, I have to beat last week's numbers every single week, since we know that once you're trained to a certain level, that adaptation to the point of, you know, true strength gains doesn't necessarily happen on a weekly basis or that quickly. And so giving people a little bit more time to adapt and like kind of shake out the rust of normal ups and downs of training week to week can be useful. So, and I would have no problem even stretching it to 3 weeks or something like that. Going much longer than that, then you start to be like, okay, is this just a separate training block? But repeating cycles of a week, of 2 weeks, of 3 weeks, I'm down with any of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. For more on how to program our low fatigue ebook, it's pretty much our current meditation on programming. So if you want to check that out, got a lot of information there on how to program, how to troubleshoot, and so on and so forth. This podcast is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. One of my goals this year was to learn a new language, picking up from where I left off last year with French. I've been consistent with getting to Rosetta Stone at least 3 times a week, usually when I'm doing some sort of steady state cardio. And I've been very impressed with how much better and how much more confident that I'm getting. It really feels like it's starting to pay off, and hopefully I'll get the chance to try it in France once again. Now, whether you're traveling, advancing your career, or just love learning, speaking a new language in 2025 is a great goal, and Rosetta Stone makes it easier than ever. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere. I use the app while I'm doing cardio most of the time. It's super convenient. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Barbell Medicine listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off now. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. This podcast is sponsored by Factor. Factor is a meal delivery service that provides nutritious, healthy meals that are dietitian approved and chef crafted. They're delivered right to your door and ready in just 2 minutes. And I've been using Factor meals a few times a week when I'm really busy with work, and I can't say enough good things about them. Eating well has never been this easy. You just heat it up and enjoy, and it gives you more time to do what you want. They have over 45 weekly menu options. You can pick the meals that fit your goals. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause and reschedule your deliveries at any time. I was recently traveling and rescheduled an order to be delivered the day I got home. It was super easy, and I didn't have to go to the grocery store right away. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. Get started at factormeals.com/BBM50off and use code BBM50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code BBM50off at factormeals.com/BBM50off for 50% off plus free shipping. This podcast is sponsored by Wonderful Pistachios. Now, I've been a Wonderful Pistachios customer for a long time prior to them coming on board, as I'll typically use their no-shells honey-roasted pistachios in my morning oatmeal and then have some no-shells sea salt and vinegar as a healthy fat source for a meal or snack in the evening. Wonderful Pistachios come in a number of other flavors, as well as different sizes for taking with you on the go, and they also have unsalted versions, which holds the sodium but not any of the flavor. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids. Like other nuts, pistachios are known for their protein power, their fiber content, and better-for-you unsaturated fats for a combination that may help you feeling fuller longer. Whether you're running between meetings, dropping off the kids, or need something on the way to the gym, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker.
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%, vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
All right, a few more questions left here. Is progressive loading required for long-term health? I assume this means that the person's actually exercising, because look, there are a lot of people who've lived into an old age who like don't exercise, and I assume no progressive loading was had. So yeah, I don't know. Blue zones, like, yeah, they, I don't know if they're progressively like walking further to get water or wine, for example. But I assume this is in the case of exercise. And so then, all right, well, what is progressive loading? So this, it's basically this principle that is formally, you know, called progressive overload, that suggests the body must be challenged by progressively greater training stimuli in order to match the individual's fitness improvements and subsequently generate fitness adaptations over time. If you didn't do this, people wouldn't get as much fitness adaptations. They wouldn't get as much strength, gain as much strength, gain as much muscle mass, cardiorespiratory fitness, so on and so forth. So how to do this? It's effectively adding something to your workout, whether it's more weight, more reps, more total volume, more distance, more pace, whatever, as you get more fit. So you get bigger, faster, stronger, and you can lift more weights, go faster, go further, etc. You don't do it in advance. Now, what would happen if you didn't do this? So I'm going to, a little thought experiment, Dr. Baraki. I'm going to have you answer this. What would happen? So let's say I'm training my dad, hypothetically. All right. And right now he's squatting. I think he squatted 125 today for a couple sets of four. I think realistically, that's probably like 75% of his actual one rep max right now. So let's just say that in perpetuity, he kept squatting 115 for sets of four. What would happen to him over time from a perspective of, we'll call them like health related adaptations. So, you know, laundry list there, and then performance related adaptations. Would it work for a while? Mm-hmm. Would he just make no gains? Like, what would happen to him?
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I suspect just by the way that this question was asked that it may reflect not an entirely accurate understanding of what we mean when we talk about this. And I have a friend here behind me that'll be on the YouTube, I guess.
Hi, Kat.
So what I would envision is he starts out squatting these loads that you have him doing up front. And he's going to likely adapt to that in some capacity. And when I say adapt, it means that he is going to gain strength. Mm-hmm. And so if you said that that set is 75% of his one rep max, then in the relatively near term, as he adapts and builds strength to that, then he will suddenly begin squatting a lower and lower percentage of his one rep max as he gains strength, right? So he's effectively training less as he goes by not matching the load to his adapted kind of potential. And so that will work for a bit to the extent that he continues gaining strength. And then in also not terribly long, he will kind of tap out the maximum amount of strength adaptations that he's able to get out of that particular load. And I think that over the medium term, that is actually, he would be fine from a health standpoint, right?
Yes.
The thing is that over the long term, over a long enough time scale, everyone dies, right? And so there's some pathway to that death that involves a degree of regression. And so there will then, over time, become a point where, as his body kind of regresses, due to a combination of, you know, more trips around the sun and a lack of that stimulus, then that percentage of one rep max that he is squatting will interestingly start to come back up again to the point where it does eventually become 75% again. And then, ooh, it became 80, 85%, 90, 95%, one rep max. I can't lift this at all anymore beyond a certain point. And I think that that is kind of the natural trajectory of everyone's strength across the lifespan. The idea is that we want to stretch that out as much as possible to where we gain much of that strength as early in life as we can, maintain it as long as we can, and then that like decline period, you know, is as abbreviated as possible. In other words, when you die, you want your 1RM to be as high as you can.
I think that, I like that.
That's a good short quote. There you go.
Yeah.
And so that would be what I would expect from a performance standpoint. And honestly, I think that the health standpoint, he's actually likely to enjoy health benefits from that for a while. I do think that, you know, the idea here, again, the way I understood or I interpreted the question being asked is under the more traditional view of progressive overload, where do I have to force more weight on the bar to get health benefits, rather than the way that we're talking about it as you get stronger, you need to kind of, you know, adjust it to keep up with your adaptations, to match your adaptations, right? And so to the extent that you are responding at all to your training, the load should naturally increase to keep up with it, right? And so it's not necessarily something that you must actively do, but rather something that almost like needs to happen to keep pace with you as you adapt, which is a tough thing for folks to wrap their mind around if they're not used to this concept.
Yeah, I think that training shouldn't get harder or easier over time. Rather, you should adjust training to keep it the same level of difficulty, generally speaking, over time. And so when I think about just load, like the weight on the bar in my you know, thought experiment here, he's likely to receive pretty near maximal strength and hypertrophy benefits from that type of workout for a pretty good period of time until he falls out of this sort of effective intensity range.
Yeah.
Once that becomes, I don't know, 55%, I'm like, nah, it's probably too light now, right?
Yeah.
And at that point, he's getting less, certainly performance benefits, but I also think less health-related benefits too, because I do think that training that makes people stronger, makes them actually gain muscle mass or whatever, works better for health than just going through the motions and moving your body, which, to be clear, is better than not going through the motions and not moving your body. But I think that the actual adjustments in load, so weight on the bar, reps, total training load, all these sort of things, it doesn't need to be micromanaged week to week. It doesn't need to be micromanaged every other week, every third week, every fourth week. I could actually envision a scenario where no variable actually changes over, I don't know, a five-week period, an eight-week period, and people could do pretty well because there's sufficient, you know, range of viable intensities, viable sort of workloads. And so, like, until it becomes far too light to work, it's still going to be fine.
Yeah.
So when people are like, I got to add 1 pound to the bar this week.
Right. Yeah.
Or even I got to add 5 pounds to the bar today. I'm like, no, you don't. If it was sufficiently hard last time, you are highly likely to be smack dab in the middle, or maybe even towards the upper end of this sort of viable intensity range, VIR, trademark. And until you get too low or too high, you're going to be fine. Right. So I think that generally speaking, when people are asking this type of question, I agree with you. They're trying to add weight to the bar too quickly. And it's like, you don't have to, bro. If you got a 405 squat right now for a set of four, for example, and it feels like RPE 8, don't add weight to the bar until it's like RPE less than 5. At that point, you've gained enough strength where you're like, hey, I actually do need more weight on the bar because it's too light. You know, obviously that's a gross oversimplification, but just to illustrate my point here.
Yeah. That's a strategy. And I think that some people are going to be better or worse fits for that style of training based on their mentality and the way they go about it. But at the same time, if you go about it in the more aggressive way where you do try to add more weight onto the bar every week, maybe you progress a little bit faster for any number of reasons, but also you may be incurring a little bit of a higher injury risk from trying to force something that ain't there. You know, I could see both sides of that coin.
I personally employed this strategy on my bench press for my last meet. The only thing that changed loading-wise was my top like single sort of thing. I would adjust that based on how strong I perceived I was. Sometimes I was right, sometimes I was wrong. But all of my back-off sets for, I don't know, 9 weeks, eight, whatever it was 297. It was 68.5%, and I just did all of my volume work at 297. I never went up, I never went down. I just did that because I was like, I can handle a lot of volume here. I don't get sore. And I, you know, as far as my technique, it's also excellent. My technique mm-hmm. is also excellent at that load. And so I was like, I'm just going to try this, see what works.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Bench 200 kilos. There you go. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. We're going to have to come up with a program where it's like, do nothing. The do nothing program.
Do nothing, but try really hard to move the bar fast. Yeah.
I like that. All right. Two questions left here. Does getting stronger over many years build significant muscle mass? Austin, what do you think about that just off the cuff?
I mean, I think that the longer you train and the stronger you get, there's probably a closer correlation between your strength and the amount of muscle mass that you have, particularly if you achieve very high levels of strength. In other words, I think that if I could have done a DEXA scan or something on myself and quantitated the amount of muscle mass that I carried when I deadlifted 750 compared with when I deadlifted 700 versus when I deadlifted, you know, 600 or 500, I do think that there would be a general upward trend. It might not actually be perfect because I think that some of that variation in performance obviously is also mediated by skill, by neurological adaptations, things like that. But I think you'd see a reasonable upward trend. I mean, we've seen that at the highest levels of competitive strength and power sport, that the correlation between force production or strength and like muscle cross-sectional area gets to actually be tighter and tighter at very high levels of performance. Whereas like early on, there's very little correlation between that because so much of the strength performance is neurologically mediated and not as much due to muscle cross-sectional area and things like that. But over many, many years, I mean, if you've been training productively, you've maximized as many of the levers as you can. So you'll have the most neurological adaptations, the most muscle adaptations, the most tendon adaptations, the most technical adaptations, things like that. And so, yeah, I would expect a gradual upward trend. I don't think that that's indefinite. I mean, I think that, but you know, we're to the extent that we are no longer willing to gain significant amounts of overall body weight, I mm-hmm. think that we have probably achieved about as much muscle as our frames are willing to carry in the absence of pharmaceutical manipulation. And so that's kind of my take on that.
Oh, well, I'm going to a little gentle pushback.
Sure.
I mostly agree. However, I don't think that either of us have ever run a program for a significant amount of time that was, you know, its major priority was muscular hypertrophy, it, you know, to the exclusion of all else. Like one rep max strength be damned, compound movement performance be damamed. We're really just going to try to max out how much muscle mass you can gain. So I would suspect that even if right now you or I adopt a bodybuilding program and we ran it for, 12 weeks, 16 weeks, like half a year, for example, we'd gain muscle mass.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't suspect that that would increase our strength in the movements that we care about, squat, bench, deadlift, because all that new muscle mass needs to be highly coordinated to actually do squat, bench, deadlift. And we'd have to give up some of that training to train the rest to generate muscle hypertrophy. But I think to this question is like, look, what's the overlap between strength training and hypertrophy training? And it's a pretty big, the Venn diagram. It's not a circle, but there's a lot of overlap. So a good strength training program is going to increase muscular hypertrophy. A good hypertrophy program is going to increase strength in the movements that are being trained. However, prioritizing one over the other is likely to get you further down that particular aspect than just training over time, right? So like you and I are mostly strength trained individuals. We are leaving certainly hypertrophy gains on the table because we have not, you know, with single-mindedly, you know, focused towards that. Same thing for bodybuilders. Yeah, they've achieved a significant amount of strength gains, but they have not single-mindedly pursued one rep max strength. And so, there's some additional adaptations to be had there. But to answer this guy's question, yes, they're likely to build a significant amount of muscle mass, just not the most amount of muscle mass. And I like to bring this guy up because he has the best nickname in all of strength sports, Tanner Seguir, Olympic weightlifter. He snatched something like 440, close to 200 kilos or whatever. It was a world record at the time. His nickname, the muscle-less wonder. Amazing. Just imagine, like, if you can snatch close to, I actually don't know that it was 200 kilos, but I thought it was real heavy. I thought it was like 190 something. We can Wikipedia this. But if he's snatching anywhere near that, what do you think his front squat is? Probably like close to 500. Yeah. And, you know, and he was a 70 something kilo competitor and his legs are like not that big. And you're like, you imagine being called the muscle-less wonder and being able to lift all this weight.
Yeah, I just looked some things up. I think you were mixing up a snatch and clean and jerk. So he clean and jerked 195 and he snatched 172.5. Which is pretty impressive for, I think, he's a 77 kilo lifter. Pretty darn good.
pretty good, but not a lot of muscle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, if you want to figure out like, how do we blend these two? So imagine someone's like, well, yeah, I do want to get stronger, but I also want to build a lot of muscle mass. What would a program look like? It would look like our power building or hypertrophy programs. Those would be the two type of programs to run. All right. Last question. Save the best for last, Dr. Baraki. We're gonna shit on doctors. Why do you think some MDs get sucked into promoting fad diets? Do you want to start on this, or you want me to?
I mean, I can hypothesize. I guess I think the first thing is that doctors are humans, and so humans get sucked into all sorts of things. There's not, you know, anything that fully, you know, protects them from natural kind of conspiratorial type thinking, which is very common in like the fad diet space, or dollar signs making people do certain things. And so those are probably the first two things that come to mind that would attract people in that direction. But those are just my off the dome thoughts. What do you think?
Well, my thing is like, in generally speaking, I think that the number of physicians that do in fact promote fad diets, whether it is for financial gain, whether it is due to conspiratorial thinking, I think that they're a statistical outlier. There's just not that look, if there's 100 of them, fine. But there's 12 million physicians worldwide. So all you're seeing here is the impact of social media and like these platforms that people have with very, you know, large microphones, and they can, say whatever. That all being said, I would suspect that if nutrition education was better in medical school and more doctors got exposed to this, maybe that would be lessened. But because it's such a small number of physicians, and generally they they just do seem to all follow the same damn pathway. It's like functional medicine, longevity type stuff, and then they start spewing nonsense about nutrition. I don't know that it would help. I just it's my feel-good story. I'm like, look, if we increase nutrition training, behavior change counseling training, like made doctors learn how to cook and do this stuff, it would help society. And then you on the other end, the Night King, you're like, nah.
Yeah, I'm less convinced that it would have a huge effect. I think it would maybe have some positive in some folks, but at the same time, those who maybe come into medical school already with a conspiratorial mindset, maybe they're just going to already come in, you know, ready to reject this as, well, this is the dietary guidelines from the government. Dude, and I'm not listening to this or whatever, you know.
I had the opposite experience. You go back 2010, 2011, Jordan Feigenbaum. You're like, hey, what's the best diet I can eat for health? And I'm like, it kind of probably looks like the paleo diet, but with like more carbs, like, you know, less, not processed stuff, but mostly like paleo, you know, whatever. And maybe you avoid gluten and whatever. And the saturated fat stuff's all bullshit. So like, don't worry about it.
Yeah, right.
And so it's not that was like miles away from what I think now is like the quote optimal diet. It's just too rigid. Right. I'm like, well, there's a lot of different ways you could do it. You could be vegan, you could be vegetarian, you could be like paleo-ish, it could be, you know, whatever. And I wouldn't be as hard-lined on like eliminating gluten from the diet. I wouldn't be as hard-lined about, you know, I would maybe be more hard-lined about saturated fat and eating all this red meat, probably not the best, eat more plant foods, stuff like that. But as soon as I was introduced to like scientific evidence and the hierarchy of scientific evidence and like had to consume it like pretty regularly, I was like, it was like a rite of passage. You have to go through like, what am I reading? And then you have to, you know, you wrestle with like, okay, well, is this legit? Or is my prior belief system legit or whatever? Mm-hmm. But I actually found it very freeing in a way. I'm like, I don't have to like make this up.
Yeah.
I can, you know, I can literally stand on the shoulders of giants in the research space and I can say, look, there's multiple converging lines of evidence that have brought me to my current position right now, which, oh, by the way, isn't like my position that I own and like carved out myself. It's kind of like, this is what I think based on the evidence. And if the evidence changes, so do I.
Yeah. Not tying your identity to stuff like that is really nice, which is I think something that we enjoy the luxury of, is not having a identitarian kind of perspective on any of these things as it relates to training or nutrition. You know, I truly like don't actually care about a lot of these things in like a personal way. Just my preference is my preference. But to your point, there's a lot of ways that you can achieve success in a lot of these different areas.
Okay, a few lightning round questions and we'll wrap this up. One, do you think if we increase the nutrition education that doctors get in medical school, right now it's less than five, and like 66%, 2/3 of medical students right now get less than 5 hours of nutrition education. Do you think if we bump that up, we'll call 20 hours of the best nutrition education, I give the lecture, assuming I'm the best. Do you think that actually improves patient outcomes in primary care related to nutrition counseling?
Probably not. And the reason why is because, you know, I think you can appreciate this more so than maybe many of our audience members who have not gone through medical training, is that what you learn in medical school, even though it's, 4 years of learning a lot of stuff, it is a small amount of what ends up being applied in your day-to-day practice, right? So if I think back, for example, to like first year of medical school, how much of the material that I learned in first year of medical school is stuff that I routinely apply day-to-day when seeing real patients, making real decisions in practice in the hospital setting? Really very little, right? Mm-hmm. Most of what I do, think, decide, manage, treat is stuff that I learned and absorbed mostly in the context of residency, and then honestly from like on the job learning after residency. Mm-hmm. Medical school is necessary to lay the foundation so that you can learn what you need to learn in those subsequent steps. But I think it's just so early that if you meet a first year med student or a second year med student, and it's great if you want to introduce this stuff to them, but if it is not kind of maintained as a steady drip of exposure throughout the rest of their school and certainly throughout residency training, then it's just not something like a third year resident who is in the depths of, you know, their final rotations or seeing a full, you know, continuity clinic day or something like that. They're not thinking about what's that lecture that I had as a, you know, spring first year medical student. And so I think it's necessary. It should, you know, I'm not arguing this to say that type of education should not be increased in school, but rather that if we want to make any kind of impact on that, it needs to be more of a longitudinal, steady curriculum across medical training. And it's going to be introduced in medical school, but it needs to be more heavily emphasized in
residency,
in residency and in the specialties that are going to interface the most with things where that's relevant to be talking about, right? So if you're a neurosurgeon who specializes in like resecting glioblastomas, then maybe spending a ton of time learning nutrition education is not as valuable as spending more time in the operating room practicing cutting out these tumors. But if you're a primary care, if you're a pediatrician, if you're, you know, I don't know, maybe even an orthopedist seeing
sports
patients who have like,
sure,
you know, very obesity-related issues, arthritis, things like that, then those are all types of situations where having a bit of nutrition education and behavior change counseling under your belt would be useful. But you don't get that from a couple hours of more hours or 20 hours, 30 hours, 50 hours in medical school is not going to be enough. It needs to be spread out and maintained throughout postgraduate education as well.
It was just my ploy to like remove maybe like immunology or something, or just because like, come on, man, let's wait till we get to pathophys and like we'll get the details. All right, second question of the lightning round. Same, similar type of scenario, but it's exercise related training. So in this scenario, in medical school, there is protected time where medical students get to exercise or learn to exercise. And they get additional training on behavior change counseling related to exercise. So, hypothetically, they'd be more apt to like recommend them to patients if they're doing it or have done it, have experience with it, and are well-trained with behavior change counseling. Would that improve patient outcomes in like primary care specialties?
I also would give a similar answer here, but I'd actually be almost more in favor of this. Mainly because I think that to the extent that it could be deployed and actually get these students doing this stuff, I think it would be so much better for them as they go through their training.
Better doctors,
and
better.
I think they'd be, you know, healthier, mental health would be better, stress management would be better. They'd probably actually learn more effectively. They'd probably sleep better. A lot of things would be better. And then maybe by way of them personally directly enjoying the benefits of this, then maybe that would actually increase the uptake of it more. I still think that if it's not, you know, somehow, you know, persistent throughout residency training, then it's something that's going to fade away by the time people are actually in practice. I truly think that so little of what I was exposed to in school is stuff that I can see day to day that directly impacts things. That's not to say it wasn't necessary at the time as like a building block, as a foundation builder, but the biggest impacts on my practice were experiences in residency, working with mentors in that context, and then things that I've learned on the job since then or done my own self-directed learning since then.
Yeah. All right. That's it. End of the lightning round. You're just crusher of joy and dark night. All right. Fair enough. Well, that is a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. All of the links to the stuff we discussed in here are in the show notes below. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.